Welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. You can pay them a visit at 1530mortgage.com. A few things to get to today. As you know, trillions of dollars in COVID relief money poured from the federal government into the states over 2020 and 2021. But how well was that money tracked? Well, it turns out not so well. We're going to talk about an audit that found almost zero accountability for billions of dollars in taxpayer money. Also, I'm sure you've heard the CDC has relaxed its guidance around COVID-19, apparently deciding that American adults can finally be adults and make decisions for themselves. Why this underscores a point that I made last year about not making long-term decisions for a rapidly changing pandemic. We'll talk about that. But first, I want to follow up on a rant that I had on Wednesday's subscriber-only episode. In case you're not a subscriber or you didn't catch the Wednesday episode, here's a little taste of how the first 10 minutes of the show went. Honestly, it's too much. And 6 years of Donald Trump and the investigations and all that, I'm kind of over it. I don't like Donald Trump. If he did something illegal, I think he should be held accountable. I don't think he's above the law. But I go back to, again, Russia probe, impeachment one, impeachment two, taxes, whatever's happening in New York, his family's business dealings, all this stuff, Ivanka, Jared Kushner, whatever. I'm just over it. I want to move on from it. I want our political system to move on from these, you know, old money, old politics families, some new fresh blood in there, people who don't come with that kind of baggage, that kind of resentment towards them. People who can just focus on making the country a good place, making our state a good place, making our communities a good place, and helping us live the lives that we want to live. So essentially, I was reacting to the news at the time that was fairly new about the raid on Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago, and just the crazy reactions to it, you know, absent really any information at that time. We hadn't heard from the DOJ yet. Everything was speculation, yet we were having this just extreme reactions on both sides. And I just thought, man, it's August of 2022. We don't even elect a president, the next president, for more than 2 years. Is this what's in store for us for the next 24 plus months? Because it is exhausting. And I said all that not to say I'm not covering what's happening with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. No, I'm open-minded. If he did something illegal and he's convicted of it, then so be it. But it's like 6 years of all these investigations, and I think some of us are, I'm not going to say some of us because I feel like I'm not, but, you know, so wrapped up and so invested in anything that happens to Trump. You know, people talk a lot about Trump derangement syndrome, TDS. I think there's two kinds of Trump derangement syndrome. There's the people who believe that Trump alone is like negatively influencing their lives intentionally, like they cannot get by if he's president. It just consumes their every thought. And then there's the people who are on the total opposite end of that spectrum, who like Trump can't do anything wrong. He's above the law. His hands are totally clean. I'm not even going to entertain the idea that he might have done something illegal. And most of us are just in the middle, like, God, we're sick of all of this. God, this is exhausting. And so my whole rant was just about, look, like, remember what's important to you. Try to stay focused in your own life, your own happiness, your family's health, your family's happiness. And yes, I mean, politics influences that, but don't let it consume you. You know, in regards to what's happening at Mar-a-Lago, as always, there is a lot of speculation. I will say I was really happy to see the Attorney General come out and actually make a statement. It came way too late, more than 2 days later, but I think they understood that based on, you know, absence of information, people were creating narratives of their own. And so here's a little bit of what Merrick Garland said.
The search warrant was authorized by a federal court upon the required finding of probable cause. The property receipt is a document that federal law requires law enforcement agents to leave with the property owner. The department filed the motion to make public the warrant and receipt in light of the former president's public confirmation of the search, the surrounding circumstances, and the substantial public interest in this matter. Faithful adherence to the rule of law is the bedrock principle of the Justice Department and of our democracy. Upholding the rule of law means applying the law evenly, without fear or favor. Under my watch, that is precisely what the Justice Department is doing. All Americans are entitled to the even-handed application of the law, to due process of the law, and to the presumption of innocence. Much of our work is by necessity conducted out of the public eye. We do that to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans and to protect the integrity of our investigations. Federal law, long-standing department rules, and our ethical obligations prevent me from providing further details as to the basis of the search at this time. There are, however, certain points I want you to know. First, I personally approved the decision to seek a search warrant in this matter. Second, the department does not take such a decision lightly.
To me, you know, accountability and transparency is the only path forward here, but it's only effective if people buy into, you know, what's being told to them. And I do feel like there are, again, I go back to the two distinct forms of TDS. I think there are these extremes where it's like one side's like, I don't care what's in the warrant. I don't care what the DOJ says. I don't think Trump did anything wrong. I think it's a political hit job, and they could never be convinced. And then on the opposite side, you know, we could find out that this was totally overreaching, that this was political in nature, that it could have been done another way besides this heavy FBI raid on his home. And you have the opposite end of the spectrum of TDS that's like, oh no, Trump needs to be imprisoned, and it's just, it's exhausting, like I said. So we're going to continue to cover this on Undivided, obviously. But I think with an ounce of common sense and rational thought and open-mindedness for what could happen, I still do worry, though, that we're heading towards a cataclysmic moment in politics. I mean, we saw that after this raid happened, there was an attempted attack on an FBI field office. Guy goes in there. It was apparently like, you know, in like all heavy gear and had like a nail gun, and had he'd been on 4chan talking about, you know, the FBI. And so you don't want any of that, but I'm just worried about what's going to come of all of this. And then if President Trump runs again, just what the next 2 years are going to be like. So anyway, we'll just try to stay one foot firmly planted in reality, as we say, just one foot firmly planted in reality. And then we'll proceed from there. But I do want to talk about some other stories today and try to get away from this craziness for a moment. Oh, the good old CDC. Their guidance has served as sort of the advice for governors like Jay Inslee and Gavin Newsom for how they proceed during the pandemic. Very carefully, obviously, is how our states proceeded. But the CDC is now rolling back and loosening some of its guidance as it pertains to COVID-19, signaling really a shift in how the CDC looks at this from a pandemic to something that Americans are just going to live with. I mean, most of us have known that COVID is just something that we're going to have to live with for the better part of 2 years. It seemed like it was going to be impossible to eradicate it. And so I just think it's interesting that the CDC is now coming wise to this. But there's a couple things in his new loosened CDC guidance that I find very interesting and that seems like things that many of us were talking about months ago, if not a year ago. And that is the idea of letting functioning adults make decisions for themselves, as opposed to, for instance, in states like Washington, putting mandates down that people might not even follow anyway. So a couple things in the CDC guidance I want to touch on. First, this all of a sudden acknowledgement that you have the vast majority of the population that has some sort of protection against COVID, not just because of vaccines, but because they've had COVID before. This from the CDC guidance. CDC's COVID-19 prevention recommendations no longer differentiate based on a person's vaccination status because breakthrough infections occur, though they are generally mild, and persons who have had COVID-19 but are not vaccinated have some degree of protection against severe illness from their previous infection. How long have anti-vaccine mandate people been saying that? Seriously, how long have they been saying that? That they were previously infected, and so they didn't feel a need to get the vaccine. And now the CDC is like, oh yeah, we have a massive coverage in our country from protection against COVID because of people who've had it and people who've been vaccinated. Yeah, that's what people have been saying for like a year. And so now the CDC is saying its recommendations, they don't differentiate between someone who has a vaccine and someone who has a previous infection. Ah, interesting. Another thing from the CDC guidance, overall booster dose coverage in the United States remains low. So a pretty low number of Americans have received COVID boosters, which is concerning given the meaningful reductions in risk for severe illness and death that the booster doses provide, which I have said all along, I do think that there is data on, that being fully vaccinated can prevent you as an individual from serious illness or death. I've never disputed that. What I've always been in dispute of is how much, first of all, the efficacy of the vaccines in preventing transmission is obviously low, and whether mandates for vaccines actually make good on the intended the intent of them, which is to stop the spread. So this goes on to say, not only do boosters reduce risk for severe illness and death, but they counter the waning of vaccine-induced immunity. And this is what we talked about Monday on the show. So Governor Jay Inslee has decided to do away with something he announced at the beginning of July, which is that state workers under his purview will be mandated to get the COVID booster and to stay up to date on it to continue employment. Well, the governor has rolled that back and they're now going to make it optional. They're going to incentivize it. But that led me to question on Monday, well, why would you keep the original vaccine mandate in place? Because the governor's saying, oh, boosters aren't mandated, but the original vaccine is. Okay, so you have state workers who were vaccinated last summer. Well, based on science and data, which the governor likes, if that's all they did, then they're probably not really protected anymore. We know that the vaccine efficacy starts to wane after about 6 months. So you're not going to hire someone who didn't get the vaccine a year ago, but other people who got the vaccine a year ago but no boosters after that can still keep their jobs, even though, as the CDC says, without the booster, the initial vaccine becomes ineffective. That makes no sense. And so there's a lot of questions about whether governors like Inslee, who have vaccine mandates in place, are going to look at this CDC guidance and follow the CDC guidance and say, okay, we're no longer going to treat people who are vaccinated or unvaccinated differently, according to the CDC. That would make sense, right? And now the governor can use the CDC as cover. I mean, the governor knows that his existing vaccine mandate doesn't make any sense. He either doesn't want to take the political hit for pulling it, or he's worried about pending lawsuits over people who were fired about the vaccine mandate. So that's the only reason at this point he's not pulling it, but he could use the CDC and say, okay, the CDC guidance has been updated, so now we're gonna update our mandates to reflect that. I think that still leaves a question about, okay, what do you do with all the people you fired for not having a vaccine? And I go back to something I said repeatedly in the fall of 2021. You cannot, as a government official, make long-term decisions based on a pandemic that was rapidly changing and a pandemic that wasn't going to be around forever to that extent. So here you have the state that's firing firefighters, firing police officers during a public safety crisis, firing state troopers, firing plow drivers leading to shutdowns of mountain passes, firing ferry workers, had all these immense impacts on our infrastructure, our transportation systems, on public safety, when this is what common sense told us would happen, when we'd get to a point where it didn't really matter if you were vaccinated or not. And that's where we are. And now how do you undo all the damage that's been done? I don't think you can. You know, all the businesses that have been shuttered and never opened back up. And now finally the CDC, after more than 2 years of the pandemic, is saying, yeah, people need to, you know, be able to make decisions for themselves about how to stay safe and healthy. You think? I never thought, I was never of the mindset that mandates would work anyway. Especially when you had a governor where, you know, half the state isn't going to like him politically. And so if he tells them to do something, they might be less prone to do it. It was like carrot versus a stick. I just think that a carrot is more effective in saying, hey, coming out. And there were many governors who did this. Like, hey, here's what health officials say. Here's what you need to know about this disease. Here's what we recommend that you do to protect yourself, to protect your friends, to protect your family, to protect your neighbors. and then trust in citizens to do the right thing. I think that that's really all you can do as a government. I mean, many of the mandates weren't even enforceable anyway. So the CDC now coming full circle, picking up on narratives that folks who were deemed far right or conspiracy theorists or, you know, anti-vaccine, COVID deniers, things that they've been saying for the better part of a year. And now we're going to pretend like they weren't all vilified for the last 2 years. And now the CDC says it, and so it's all normal and we can all move on. This is what happens when people are singularly focused on politics, even in matters of public health. It results in policies and procedures that don't make any sense. Speaking of COVID, let's talk about the trillions of dollars that flooded in taxpayer money that flooded into states during the pandemic to help with the variety of issues that states were facing due to the pandemic. Well, that money needs to be tracked, and there are strings attached for states who receive that kind of federal help. No different in Washington state, where the state recently did an audit to determine how the billions in federal dollars that came into the state were used and whether they were used properly. Well, it turns out that the folks who did that audit had a really hard time finding an answer to that. To explain the situation more thoroughly, I wanted to bring in a friend of mine who knows all about this stuff. Jason, thanks for joining us for Fridays with Friends. Introduce yourself for folks who aren't familiar with you.
Great. Thanks, Brandy. I'm Jason Mercier, the Government Reform Director for the Washington Policy Center, and I've had, I guess, the pleasure of studying Washington budget and taxes for about 20 years.
You're like a budget nerd. Is that fair?
Well, I'm using an old state budget to prop up my computer, so I guess that qualifies.
Yes, I love it, though. You're always sliding into my DMs, but not with anything inappropriate, with juicy stories and details on taxes and the budget. So I always appreciate you giving me the scoop.
Well, I figure if I'm going to find the information, I should share the joy.
I love it. So there's a couple stories I wanted to have you on to talk about today that you slid into my DMs about. One of them is we know that we got a record amount in many states of federal dollars during COVID. And there has been an audit of a Washington state audit of how this money was used, $37 billion. The audit didn't go very well. Is that a good characterization?
Yeah, when an audit totals over almost 1,100 pages, you know there's going to be some interesting things in it. And this is a federal financial audit that actually happens every single year. The state auditor looks at compliance of state agencies with federal reporting requirements, because we know there's no such thing as free federal funds, and they come with a lot of strings and really stringent reporting requirements to make sure that the money is spent appropriately. But with this particular audit, this was the first one that they've got to dive in those billions, as you mentioned, of the federal COVID relief funds. And the state of Washington did not do a great job, according to the state auditor, of complying with that. In fact, they issued what they call an adverse opinion, which basically means they don't believe they have the data and the information from the state to actually verify that it was used appropriately because of lack of documentation.
So we get all these billions from the federal government, as other states did, to help with COVID relief and everything that entailed. And we didn't track the spending of that well enough for them to even perform a real thorough audit.
Yeah, they basically, on almost all of the COVID funds, they said they had an adverse opinion. But there were findings beyond it. There were over 60 findings for not complying with federal reporting. And I guess the most problematic about that are a couple of things. One, the state auditor basically said for the first time since 2003, they couldn't audit an entire program. The Department of Family Services on the child care payments they were getting from the federal government, the auditor basically said, we just couldn't audit that $273 million because of lack of documentation. And the state auditor said, you know, this is a big deal. There is a possibility the state may have to repay that $250 million back to the federal government. Along with that, 31 of those over 60 findings were repeat findings where the state had not corrected prior problems, some going back decades. So there seems to be a problem of taking these findings by our independently elected state auditor seriously, and it's taxpayer money and it's compliance with federal law.
So just, I don't know if we want to do hypotheticals, but with the $271 million that went to the families department with the state, and is it fair to say it's kind of untraceable at this point? I mean, what if there was fraud? Would there be any way to find out?
Well, this is where now there's some disagreement between the auditor and the agency. The agency says we complied with the federal requirements. We just didn't comply with the extra security the state auditor thinks is appropriate. And in fact, they say that they'd like to do that, but it's going to require more taxpayer money from Washingtonians so that they can meet that reporting requirement. So their response to the audit is, we're going to go to the legislature and ask for more money so we can actually meet these requirements recommended by the state auditor.
So they failed an audit, and they say in order to not fail future audits, they need more money?
If you want us to be able to spend the money you're sending us right now appropriately, you got to send us more, was basically the response.
It's like only a government agency could function that way.
Well, and this is why I think you saw that the state auditor actually make the statement that this is a problem. This is a big deal. And whether or not Congress or the Federal Budget Office is going to require repayment of those funds, probably not. But that's legally a possibility if they say, you know what, you are just doing such a poor job, so bad that your auditor said that she couldn't document these funds, that we think you owe it back to us.
Just playing devil's advocate, the pandemic at the beginning was a cluster F. I mean, it really was. And so could this just be the fact that they were dealing with an unprecedented amount of money that had to go to an unprecedented number of places and they just fell short because of that?
Well, that's basically the response from the Employment Security Department, because you may recall they had a little issue with over $600 million of fraud. And their response to the auditor was, well, we disagree with your findings. We think our procedures and our protections are fine, but you know, we had to get this money out fast, and improper payments are just going to be part of that, living with that consequence of having to get the money out fast. I mean, there's a lot of excuses, there's a lot of reasons, but you have an incumbent responsibility of a duty as government officials that when you take these taxpayer resources, you're going to be responsible for them, you're going to account for them, and you're going to comply with the federal requirements. And that's where this 1,100-page audit with over 60 findings said Washington failed spectacularly.
Do you know, I'm assuming other states have to audit their federal spending, or is this like a uniquely Washington thing?
No, I mean, this will come across the board. And, you know, I guess the flip side of this is there was a story out of Idaho yesterday that, you know, along with the state, local governments were eligible for these funds as well. And the story out of Idaho was that several local governments refused to take the funds because they didn't want to be under those restrictions and those burdens of having to track it, or they didn't think they were going to be able to comply with the reporting requirements. So, I mean, they took the proactive step of saying, we know there's a lot of strings, we know there's a lot of reporting requirements, and this doesn't pencil out for us, so we're not going to take the funds.
Well, that seems very responsible, not so much in Washington State. They're like, just give us the money, you know, no big deal. I love that. I want to move on to a court case that happened. Governor Jay Inslee, of course, we're still in a state of emergency around COVID. Maybe we can discuss that more in a moment. But there was a court case having to do with his authority to issue a mask mandate. Can you tell me basically the basis for the case and how it turned out?
Yeah, so this was a court of appeals ruling. It had prior been ruled by the Superior Court and upheld the mandate saying that the governor can do what he did. And this court of appeals ruling that came out this week, it was 2-1, and it wasn't a surprise. And the governor will be very boastful about the fact he's won all of these lawsuits, and there's a reason for that. The state of Washington's emergency powers are a total blank check. Basically, the governor can do whatever they want, and that's why all of these lawsuits have failed. But what was noteworthy about this is the dissent was kind of a call to the legislature saying, yes, you've given the governor this blank check, but should you? Should there be some type of sideboards? Should an emergency be indefinite with no end period? Should there be at some point an opportunity for legislative oversight? And this dissenting judge, who actually was appointed by Governor Inslee last year, pointed out that, you know, this there's a lot of responsibility with this, and there's the potential for abuse. Not that the governor, current governor, will, but who's to say that the next governor is not going to declare some other emergency and abuse that power? And that's why I think the frustration with the fact now we're over almost 900 days with this, it's not about Governor Inslee. It's not about the policies that he has imposed. It's about our form of governance and who sets policy. That's supposed to be the legislative branch, the public process, not one person behind closed doors indefinitely. And that's where we are kind of unique in Washington with a structural imbalance.
And it's been a frustration of folks like us for a long time. It's like, I think I think why you don't see Democrats in Olympia, and you can feel free to disagree, but why you don't see them so eager to rein in the governor's emergency powers is because they believe, and perhaps rightfully so, that they'll always have the governor's office. And so why would we try to rein in the power of someone who is of our political party? I mean, is there any other reason you can think of that the legislature wouldn't try to take some of its authority back?
This has really just been puzzling me for the last few years, because when you go beyond the borders of Washington, you go to Hawaii, you go to New Mexico, you go to New York. What are those states? Those are states with Democratic trifectas, governor and legislature. Those legislatures fought back against their governor's emergency powers, not because they disagreed with the policies, but because they were selfish and guarded of their branch, of their role in our republic. And they're like, you know, we're probably going to adopt this policy if you send it to us, but we're the legislature. We make these decisions, not the executive. The executive is supposed to implement policy. So this hasn't been a partisan fight across the country. I don't know why in Washington our legislators feel like they shouldn't have a role in this conversation.
Yeah, it's like they want to be hands-off, which is odd to me. It's like you wanted the job. You wanted to get elected to serve your constituents, and you get there and you're like, meh, I don't want any say in that.
And I think that the thing that most people may not realize about Washington's emergency statutes is when the governor issues an emergency order, if he waives a law, that expires after 30 days. That goes back to the legislature for approval, which is why the governor said, well, the legislature has signed off on many of my orders. Well, that's true. However, if the governor issues what's called a restrictive declaration, right? The mask mandate, closing businesses, closing schools, telling you how many people you can have at your house. Those are indefinite. Those never expire. Those aren't subject to legislative oversight. From a governance standpoint, why? What's the rational reason for treating waiving of law and putting restrictions on citizens differently? They both should have the same legislative oversight.
Yeah, and there was confusion about that at the beginning. It was really the most controversial aspects of what the governor was doing that he didn't have any oversight over and continues not to. If you were a betting man, Jason, you said, you know, we're closing in on 900 days under a state of emergency around COVID. When do you think the governor might decide that it's time to give that up?
And you are currently one of only 13 states that have an active COVID emergency. And we're one of just, I think, three that have no end date. All the other ones, because of their emergency powers law, expire unless reapproved. The governor has given us no metrics, no benchmark for when this order will expire. One possible silver lining, the CDC yesterday came out with new guidance that basically said that going forward, treating vaccinated versus unvaccinated differently in their recommendations, because I think they've estimated between being vaxxed and having prior COVID exposure, 95% of Americans have some level of immunity. So if the CDC is saying, you know, we're not going to make that distinction anymore, maybe the governor will finally come to that conclusion.
And we talked about the CDC's changes in guidance a little earlier on in the podcast. And I mean, you know, the governor came back and he, beginning of July, said that he was going to mandate COVID boosters. And then he came back earlier this month and said, never mind, we're just going to make it optional and provide some incentives. Given the CDC's new guidance, do you believe that that could impact the governor's current, because he left the original vaccine mandate in place. Do you think that that is something that could go away?
Yes, the interesting thing about his mandates for the state employees, and initially that new booster one, but now he has rescinded because he's in contract negotiations with state employees and realized, well, maybe we should incentivize that, which I'm not sure if that was science-based or political-based. You can answer that question. But that those orders are being done separate from the emergency powers orders. He's doing that as the employer. You know, as the employer, they can set the work conditions. But I guess from a standpoint of public health and from science, even if you're the employer and you have the right to do this, if all the guidance is changing nationally, what's your rationale? And, you know, I was thinking to myself also, I don't know if the Attorney General's office is still doing this, but the Attorney General would put restrictions on those attending press conferences saying you have to show proof of vaccination. Does that continue now with this new CDC guidance?
Yeah, and I was actually going to, because you were the one who sent me that, you sent me a press release, because I railed on that on the podcast about the fact that that makes absolutely no sense to prioritize a booster over access of the press to a government official. And so I had planned today, it was on my list of to-dos, to check in with the AG's office and see if they're going to lift that guidance. So I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, and you know, this will kind of tie back to our original conversation on the budget and transparency on those audits. Again, the reason why the governor was changing a mandatory booster requirement to an incentive is because he is in these contract negotiations with state employees. So a little bit of a topic change for you. Those are happening right now, and they're happening behind closed doors with no details released to the public or even to union members, right? It's just the union leadership. But there's something else that is happening in those talks, and that is discussion about pay raises for the next state budget. And we have no details about that. I do know the state employees have been saying, hey, we're getting hammered with inflation and we're having to work a lot of overtime because of inadequate staffing. And you can ask yourself why there's inadequate staffing right now in state agencies. But they're making the case about why they should have a pay raise. Probably a good case, but I think the same argument could be made for the rest of Washingtonians who haven't had any type of tax relief provided for the past couple of years. Yeah, we've got this process right now, just like with the emergency powers, we're behind closed doors. The governor's office is negotiating and will be making these decisions, and the legislature can't change what he agrees to. It's just an up or down vote.
Yeah, I mean, accountability, transparency is something that should be non-controversial, and there's a lot of aspects in our state, at least, where we just don't see it, and this is one of them. Well, Jason, I appreciate your time and your expertise. Like I said, just a budget nerd, and I love it.
Well, you know, I've got to share the budget joy, so I appreciate being on with you today. Thank you.
It's Friday. That means it's time for our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
And here to help us understand what's happening in the Sunshine State is our Florida correspondent, my sister Miranda. Hello.
Hello. I don't even understand what's happening in the Sunshine State, but I'll do my best.
Never a shortage of headlines. So when we got on kind of like our pre-call today, you were like, I know you don't want to talk about Trump because your podcast on Wednesday, you just whined about him, but I want to start with a Trump story. So go ahead.
Okay. And to be fair, this one kind of even supports your podcast. So this one, WFLA.com says, Florida man taunts Trump by flying a ha 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 banner over Mar-a-Lago. The article goes on to say, NBC6 reports a plane with a banner reading, ha 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 ha, circled above Trump's Palm Beach estate days after federal agents executed a search warrant on the property. Apparently, this man out of Miami, who's a Democratic activist, paid $1,800 to have this banner flown over top of some people who were standing outside in support of Trump. And in a way, just trying to like stick it to them, telling them that they should find something better to do with their time. And ironically, I think he should have found something maybe better to do with his money.
I agree on both fronts. I mentioned this earlier in the podcast. I think that there's two types of Trump derangement syndrome. The people who think like, orange man bad, ruining my life. I can't function if he's president. And then the people who think he can't do anything wrong. And so I think that we're talking about two distinctly different, yet very similar groups of people.
A match made in heaven, possibly.
Yeah, so let them taunt each other until, you know, they just tucker each other out. Okay, turns out, we have quite the homeless problem up here. I've been to Miami. Yes, there's some homeless people. I mean, if I were going to be homeless, I would definitely prefer Miami to Seattle to a certain degree. But there's an interesting proposal afloat down there about what to do with the homeless.
NBC6 Florida says Miami homeless plan for Virginia Key is actually on hold. The city of Miami, we have this beautiful arrangement of islands just off the coast of the city. One of them is Key Biscayne. And between Key Biscayne and Miami, there's a beach called Virginia Key Beach. And it's this beautiful kind of uninhabited oasis that kind of would remind you of something off of Pirates of the Caribbean. It's so just natural. And the city of Miami wants to build 50 to 100 tiny homes to put on this island and allow these homeless people to live there, to be out of the city and away from like tourist destinations. And the county kind of came in and was like, no, but the city's like, you're not helping us do anything about it because all the homeless, all the cell, like the help and the groups that are here to help homeless people are all in Miami. So Miami deals with the homeless situation of the county, and the county seems to not be putting in a lot of effort to help the city. So the city came up with this idea and they were going to move forward with it. And then suddenly they were like, getting pushback from the county, and the county wants them to come up with other places.
It's similar to Seattle, where Seattle has to deal with, I mean, all the homeless people are in Seattle, but for good reason, because Seattle just kind of lets them be without any intervention, and less so across King County. But when I think this, so some people joke here like, oh, just put all the homeless on an island or something. And I just think it's funny that in Florida, they're actually talking about putting the homeless on an island. But I've been to the Keys, and this sounds like something that I would want to do. Like, I want to live in a tiny house on the beach.
Absolutely. The rent prices are skyrocketing, and I can get a free tiny house on a beach. I might think about that if this goes through. I really hope it doesn't, though, because honestly, Virginia Key Beach is very beautiful. It's not part of the Florida Keys archipelago or whatever they call those, but it's right off of Miami, and we like to call our islands Keys down here. So, but it's gorgeous. I even wanted to do a photo shoot for Halloween there with my friends. So I'm like, please don't put homeless encampments on my photo shoot property.
I also want to talk about this controversy in Florida over the Gadsden flag.
This is a new license plate that is available for pre-order in Florida. I believe the proceeds of this specialty license plate go to benefit of a veterans foundation, because most specialty license plates go back to help something. We have Save Our Seas and all types of fun plates here in Florida. But this one is, it features the Gadsden flag, and it's black and it's very bold. And I think it's pretty cool looking, but I also don't look at the flag in any sort of way that's connected to something negative. I look at it connected to the American Revolution and freedom and liberty and really cool, amazing American things. But a lot of people don't see it that way. They actually find it to be a very negative connotation, completely directly connected with right-wing groups.
Yeah, and that's what's disappointing about it. Like, so as you said, you know, and for people who aren't familiar, the Gadsden flag is the curled up snake with the don't tread on me, and it's yellow and black. And it was, yeah, like you said, during the American Revolution, it was a military flag. And now it's like right-wing extremism. It's just annoying how you can have the most fringe people co-opt a flag for their particular movement, and then it ruins the flag for everyone. It's almost like, I mean, to some extent, the American flag as well. It's like, I have a few American flags outside my podcast studio here, and I'm constantly worried, like, is some left-wing crazy person gonna, like, steal my American flags? Like, they think it's like you're some, being a patriot or loving your country is right-wing. It's very disappointing.
It really is, because honestly, America's pretty awesome, and the whole beginning of America is super awesome. And I feel like to allow anybody to take something from that time of our country and turn it to something negative is very frustrating. So I think we should push back on that, and everybody should go order their Gadsden flag.
Yeah, I mean, the meaning of the Gadsden flag is very relevant to the times that we're going through right now with the pandemic and all of that, and the idea of don't tread on me and government overreach. I will say there is one flag from history where I feel like the controversy around it is founded, and that's the Confederate flag. I don't disagree with people who don't want that flown anywhere. I know there were some states who it was almost incorporated into their flags and they got rid of it, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think the Florida flag still kind of has a little remnants there for it. But I mean, going back to license plate, New Hampshire has a license plate that says live free or die. That's pretty cool. Like, I love that, you know. And what, Washington, D.C., taxation without representation, like little reminders. And kind of also going back to our first story, somebody had asked me if I won that $1 billion Mega Millions, what is the most dumb thing I would do with my money? Like something stupid. And I actually said that I would fly like constitutional amendments and explanations around the country behind like airplanes.
Yeah, we are our father's daughters. I told people that constitution was the first word my dad taught me to spell. And like, I feel like at a young age, I mean, you were named after, for people who don't know or haven't put it together, Miranda versus the state of Arizona.
Yep, I was named after Ernesto Miranda, so.
Well, let's end with an update on Florida's ongoing hunt of invasive snakes, because that always, I think we need a light note. I don't know if snake murder is a light note, but we'll end with that.
I don't know. Well, yeah, we're going to check in with the hunters. So Fox 35 in Orlando is just kind of giving us an update, and they say snake hunters in Florida find a massive 104-pound Burmese python near Big Cypress National Preserve. Big Sur Ipris is basically kind of the western side of the Everglades. It's very beautiful. It's not so prairie-like. It's got big, giant cypress trees and Spanish moss and air plants everywhere, and it looks very Jurassic Park. So I'm sure this snake looked right at home and felt right at home over there, but not anymore.
When do they name the winner of the snake hunt? Is there, there's a specific winner, right?
There is a specific winner. I believe it's a 10-day competition that started at the beginning of the month. So I think it probably just ended. But there is a winner. There's prizes. So there's the most snakes, the largest snake. We'll find out. I'm going to check in. So next week, maybe I can give you an idea of who the winner was. And maybe they weren't a Florida man. Maybe the winner is another state man or woman.
Probably not. But we do expect a full report on the winner. All right, Miranda, thank you for the update on what's happening in the Sunshine State. We appreciate it.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
It's Friday. That means we end the show with an important text from American history. And since my sister and I were just talking about our dad and his love for the Constitution, I wanted to read the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. This was one of my dad's least favorites. And if you follow the news cycle, you might know why I chose this one today. Always good to know which amendments are which and to have some information. So the 16th Amendment, cue the patriotic music. Okay, thank you. The 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Does anybody know who it is, what it is? Anybody? What's the 16th Amendment? If you said it has to do with taxes, you are correct. It was passed in 1909. It was ratified in 1913. And it is very short. It reads as follows. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Very short. The 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Nothing in here about hiring 87,000 additional people to work for the IRS, but pretty broad tax authority for the federal government. So now you know the 16th Amendment, if you didn't already. I wanted to read a couple comments to close the show about my Wednesday episode. Again, if you're not a subscriber, we do an episode like this every week. So if you like the Monday, Friday episodes, you got to become a subscriber on Patreon or Locals and hang with us on Wednesdays. We have a lot of fun. As I mentioned, I had just like an extensive rant about the state of politics, my concern about us speeding towards this terrible moment in the U.S. political system. I just wanted to read a couple comments in response to that. Christopher wrote, great episode as always, Brandy. Your opening well described how I've been feeling lately as well. Thank you. Mike said, and this bummed me out. I'm sorry to hear this, Mike. He said, our family dog of 15 years passed away today. Seriously, we have a 14-year-old dog. And so I just feel terrible for you, Mike. And so from my family to yours, our condolences for the loss of your dog. He went on to say, sometimes people need to forget about politics and focus on real life. Today, I needed to focus on politics to escape real life. Good episode, and thanks for the distraction. You're welcome. Jack said, good to know that I am not alone in my concern regarding the future of our country. I can tell that you are truly burdened by this storm that is brewing. I believe the pride and selfishness of our longtime, quote, leaders are setting the stage for destruction, but my hope and focus are on the calm afterward. Thanks for what you do. I think that's very well put, Jax. And I think I heard from some people too who were like, well, you know, you might not want to put your emotional energy into it, but these are serious issues. If you've got political persecutions, X, Y, Z, and I agree. I'm not going to stop covering these things, but I think we just need to always make sure that we keep in mind what we're on this planet for, our health and happiness, the health and happiness of our family and our loved ones, and try to spend at least as much emotional energy on that as you do worrying about what's happening in Washington, D.C. I think that's just a healthy way to move throughout our lives. All right, that's it for this episode of Undivided. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. I hope you find this to be a place and a show where you can hear Common Sense, where you can have your ideas heard and share your thoughts on the issues without being vilified or without being attacked. And so I do appreciate you guys being here. Again, if you want to become a subscriber, you can do that for as little as $5 a month for like 3 or 4 extra episodes a month. You can do that at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Pay them a visit at 1530mortgage.com.